listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
January 19th, 2019. This is Deanna Spangola, and I'm broadcasting from the very snowy Chicago suburbs. I appreciate you joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org. Now, I go through the same spiel every week, and sometimes I think, well, if I say something once, people will understand and they'll get it. But I notice that that other broadcasters, particularly professional people and regular radio, repeat things several times in order to, so that the audience, the listeners, can get it. But I do invite you to subscribe to SpangolaSpeaks.net and ScreeningSandyHook.net. And during the program, if you have questions or comments, you may post them at comment@spangola.email. And I invite you to visit our chat room, spangola.chatango.com. Now, if you want to see who I've had on in the past, and I've had some very, very interesting guests over the last, 8 years, and just exceptional people. As today, we have an exceptional individual visiting today. But if you visit spangola.com, on the left, you will see a button, a radio schedule. Goes all the way back to October 23rd, 2010. And you may see who I've had on the program. You can click on the links that I provide. And it really is a great resource. And the other resource that I already mentioned, of course, is SpangolaSpeaks.net, where you may find audio files of those programs. Plus, you can make comments about the program. And, of course, RepublicBroadcasting.org also provides audio files of past programs. So if you miss a week, don't worry about it. You can catch it when you have the time. My guest today is Lance LaRusso. He is the author of two books, When Cops Kill and Blue News. And those are both available, and you can get the Kindle version. Lance LaRusso is a problem solver. He is a trusted advisor for his clients. As a litigator with a healthcare and law enforcement background, which is amazing. Your background is so diverse and so incredible. It's fabulous. Anyway, Lance focuses his practice on general liability defense for individuals and corporations, in medical malpractice defense, healthcare law and catastrophic personal injury, and wrongful death cases on behalf of injured parties and affected families. And it's very timely for Lance to be visiting this week. Didn't plan it specifically, but it's certainly timely that he is visiting. Just after the sentence was handed down yesterday. Anyway, Lance, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what did you think about, or do you want to address this later, but what did you think about the sentence and, of Jason Van Dyke? And, there's a lot of mixed feelings. And of course, this the death of Laquan McDonald occurred in 2014. There was a video. It's caused a lot of people to take sides. And anyway, what are your views on this?
Well, the video, obviously, you know, one of the remarks that, and I had done a bunch of interviews about this before, one of the questions that came up in the first place was, you know, so someone had a knife. Is a knife dangerous? And people said, you know, it's a small knife. And the question of how many shots were fired. One of the big questions that came up to start with is just understanding the mechanics of the use of force and realizing that irrespective of the size of the knife, I need, you know, to explain to folks that any size of a knife can be deadly. And, you know, when we were also looking at the number of shots fired, people were commenting, you know, why would an officer shoot that many times? You know, officers are trained to shoot very quickly. And just basically going back and saying, well, an officer shot a certain number of times, it absolutely, you know, means that they did something wrong. You know, it was going to be a judgment call on the fact that, you know, there was a sentencing and the officer was found to have done something wrong. You know, that's unfortunately the judgment calls officers have to make. The question now is what happens in the city? Is there going to be a call for training or is it going to be a call for violence? And that's one of the biggest problems that a lot of folks don't understand. When you're dealing with these situations, generally officers do not, I don't know any officers who have gone to work and said, you know, I'm just going to hurt somebody today. So even when there is a mistake made in a split-second decision, most of the time it's a training issue. I know one of the issues, I don't know if it came out in the trial, was that the officers in Chicago had been screaming for tasers for years. Yet we have people that were second-guessing the officer saying, well, why didn't the officer have a taser? So a lot of luck is going to have to come out in the breakdown of the verdict.
Right. Now back in April of 2013, I took an NRA class. I am a gun owner. I have a FOID card and all that. And a lawyer, an attorney came in and it was an all-day class from 8 in the morning till 5:30, 6 o'clock at night. And he was talking about what a policeman could do and what he couldn't do. And he said that if somebody comes into your home and is walking out with your TV and you shoot him and then drag him back in, you could be arrested because he was not physically threatening you. You have to feel physically threatened. And he said you cannot shoot somebody in the back because obviously you're not being physically threatened. And so what bothered me about the Laquan McDonald situation is that he was walking away. He wasn't threatening the officer. He wasn't threatening Van Dyke. And I thought it was a little bit, to use a pun, or it's not a pun, but it was overkill. Really, 16 shots in the back?
Well, let's go back, first of all. The notion that somebody can never get shot in the back or that you can't ever shoot somebody in the back is wrong. A person can be a danger. A person can be use deadly force if a person is a danger to themselves or others. So the first analysis you have to make is there someone else that the person could be a danger to? Now, the scenario, and that scenario is used very often, somebody's walking out of your house with your television. The real reason you can't use deadly force is the only crime involved is a property crime. They haven't done anything to an individual personally. And in that situation, if they're walking out of the house and they're not a danger to a third party, then yes, you can't use deadly force. But the blanket statement that someone cannot be shot in the back lawfully is a problem. First of all, I can use deadly force to protect myself or a third party. And if that third party is in the direction of where the suspect's walking, but I'm behind the suspect, there's nothing unlawful about using deadly force and shooting someone in the back. The second thing is that a person can be pointing a firearm at the suspect, at a person, and still the only target presented is their back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really interesting. We have, it's not just the back. We have officers criticize and someone says, well, you know, they shot him in the side. They shot him here. People don't stand still like they do in Cary Cooper movies. Suspects are being shot at. We also train officers to move when they're shooting. So a lot of times you'll have shootings where somebody is shot and it's not completely in the front of their chest. Well, you wouldn't expect that if both parties are moving at the same time.
Right. Well, it's just, what about releasing the video? We don't, it was kind of interesting the way that it came out, and then there were accusations that the mayor and the chief of police were concealing information. There's been so much controversy over this. I expected a lot of violence last evening, but I don't believe that it occurred. Not that I've been paying any attention to the news, but I don't believe that it occurred.
Yeah, the question of releasing the video in that case, I agree with you, has become so convoluted. I don't even know what the facts are anymore. So the video being withheld for a period of time is not unusual because obviously you're trying to vet witnesses. So if somebody says, well, I saw what happened, holding the video back allows you to make sure that person really saw what happened and didn't just hear it from a third party. So holding a video on for a while is generally a accepted law enforcement practice. One of the issues in that situation, as I understand it, is it was withheld for an extended period of time, and then it was released, and it was released after, some wailing and gnashing of teeth by people who were asking for it. So, you know, it's so convoluted, it just becomes an issue of, it's almost outside of the norm. So the question of releasing videos has come up many times. Should law enforcement release them quickly? Should they release them afterwards? And generally what law enforcement is coming up with now is as long as there's an opportunity to vet witnesses and gather who they believe really saw what happened and preserve the integrity of the investigation, a lot of departments are releasing the videos pretty quickly. Part of the problem with releasing the videos pretty quickly is the video will never show you the officer's perspective. Body cameras don't see the same way officers do in low light and no light. Body cameras don't move with the officer's eyes. They're mounted either on their chest or their head. And in addition, the body camera doesn't have any peripheral vision. It also distorts distance. The body camera uses, in order to get as wide a field as possible, the body camera uses a fisheye lens. Anybody who's ever rented a hotel room and gotten there and said, you know, it looked bigger on the internet, that's the reason why, because they photographed it with a fisheye lens. Mm-hmm. So the body camera's not going to answer all the questions, but we do know that they have started releasing body cameras quicker. And one reason, quite frankly, is the body cameras often clear the officers if there's a way to explain why the officer did what they did. We have seen body camera released before where people said, if you look at that body camera, you see the officer should not have done X, Y, and Z when the camera requires some explanation. The use of force, lawful force, justified force, will never look good on video.
The other thing, too, of course, it has been so politicized. The release to the public has been exploited by politicians because people are running for mayor. And I don't know that it should be released to the public, because then the people are really tried by the general public, when I don't think that's such a great idea. I think that it shouldn't be that way. Am I wrong?
Well, there are some concerns about jury tampering or jury influencing. And to that extent, every person is entitled to a fair trial. But on the flip side, I would definitely not be in favor of never releasing body camera video. The bottom line is it's a public record, and the public has access to those records in a government in a democracy such as we have. So the timing of the release of the video is important, and several judges have withheld videos throughout the United States because they were concerned about being able to strike a fair and impartial jury.
Mm-hmm. Right. What do you think about the verdict yesterday? Was it fair? Was it, do you think that Van Dyke received a fair trial?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. This is the problem that we have with juries and verdicts and trials. The jury sees evidence we never see while we're watching TV. The jury sees evidence we never see when we just read newspaper accounts or we just watch a video. So there's actual, all I can tell you is when you're looking at an appeal, the standard in a criminal or a civil appeal is that the jury verdict is presumed to be right unless there's a reason it's not. And, you know, the citizens there looked at all of the evidence and made a judgment call. So whether we agree with it or not, we have to respect it. And like I said, I'm sure that they reviewed evidence that I haven't seen, that I don't know, and that the vast majority of people do not know.
Okay. And that's something that, when you just receive bullet points in the news, that's something that people aren't going to consider at all. They're just going to believe what they hear on the news, depending on their partiality and their biases, of course, and everybody has biases.
And that's what we talk about in Blue News, in the book Blue News, and all the prophets from Blue News, When Cops Kill, another fiction book called Peacemaking. All the profits from those books go to law enforcement charities. To date, we've donated about $22,000 to law enforcement charities. But we talk about in Blue News the fact that these stories tend not to get a lot of coverage if an officer is cleared. So I represented an officer who was involved in a shooting. It made international news. The officer was cleared by a grand jury. The officer was cleared by the U.S. Attorney's Office. And when it was finally over and the officer was cleared at every level possible, the only coverage was one paragraph in a local newspaper.
Oh, gosh.
And that's not common.
On a number of issues. So that's unfortunate. There were people, I did see the news last night, there were some religious leaders in the Chicago area who were calling for changes. And that's something that you address. And it's not just in the Chicago area, but you indicate that there are ministers, pastors nationwide who are asking for changes in how law enforcement investigates officer-involved shootings. Now, what kind of changes are people calling for?
Well, people are calling for a lot of things, and the vast majority of what I've heard them calling for indicates that they're completely naive about criminal investigations. What's interesting is the city of Chicago has a very well-known, if not legendary, law enforcement review procedure. They have a panel that reviews law enforcement. One of the best training programs that I've seen, and it's different communities, is a program to train the general public about interactions with law enforcement. So we have, for example, this concept that law enforcement officers need more de-escalation training. Well, it takes two people to de-escalate a situation, the officer and the person the officer is dealing with. If the person the officer is dealing with refuses to comply with the officer's commands, refuses to show their hands, runs when the officer asks them to stop, or just otherwise is confrontational or attacks the officer, then there will be no de-escalation of that situation. So the Fraternal Order of Police and a couple of groups of pastors in different communities have started holding classes to teach people how to act when they're stopped by the police, whether it's a traffic stop or it's a stop on the street, to try to keep the situations from changing to an encounter where the level of force goes up just from noncompliance.
Wow. And we have seen on the news where people are stopped for just a routine traffic violation. We have a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. We'll pick this up on the other side. Be right back. All righty, welcome back. is Deanna. While that commercial, that last commercial was just a little bit dated, the information that our guest today, Lance LaRusso, is giving to us is quite timely, very timely. And we, just before we went to break, we were talking about regular traffic violation stops, and that sometimes the officer has a gun pulled on him and is shot, which is pretty scary. I personally would never want to be any kind of a police officer, because I think it takes a great deal of courage to be in an unpredictable situation. And like many people, I'm not crazy about unpredictability. So.
Yeah, they're all unpredictable situations. You know, so far this year, we've had 13 law enforcement officers murdered in the line of duty. Two of them, maybe three, were ambushed. They were just attacked for wearing the uniform.
Wow. That is, that's pretty terrible.
Yep, it happens every year.
In your book, The When Cops Kill, you talked about, before you were talking about how things become escalated, and it takes a certain amount of finesse in talking to a suspect or somebody that is committing a crime, and you give a situation in which a child was being held with a knife to his throat, a butcher knife. He was a little boy on the suspect's lap, and the suspect had a butcher knife up to the child's throat. Now, you indicate that you were an EMT, an emergency medical technician. Now, and so you knew exactly of the vulnerability of the situation. So tell us a little bit about that situation.
Yeah, actually, I was the officer. The suspect was holding a three-year-old hostage at knife point. It was his living girlfriend's son, and he was moving the knife up and down on his neck, and closer to the top of his neck, the closer we got to him. So he was threatening to kill him, and we were trying to talk him out of it, talk him into dropping it, and eventually my partner was able to get close enough and grab his wrist and the knife, and I was able to put a gun to his forehead, and he decided to give up.
Wow. That could have ended so tragically had you
We were in there for about 40 minutes with him. So.
Right. Now, typically, when there are shootings or any kind of emergency or a situation like you describe in the book, does an EMT arrive on the scene just automatically?
Sure. As soon as an officer indicates that shots have been fired or that somebody's injured, emergency medical staff, and even before that sometimes if the dispatch indicates that somebody may be injured, they do what's called staging. So they will show up at the fire department and EMS, will find a safe place nearby where they can be close if they're needed, because obviously they can't go in until the scene is secured. That's one of the reasons why we hear on the news all the time, well, why did the officer handcuff somebody after they shot them? Well, it's because EMTs don't carry body armor, and sometimes suspects who are shot have another weapon. The officer does their best to try to obtain it, even if it's a knife, so they're handcuffing them, so it's safe for EMS to come in and treat them.
Okay. And so anytime that people, if there's reportings of shootings, the emergency medical technicians are always involved, correct?
Yes, they would be responding.
Okay. So this ended well. That little child must have been just terrified.
He was.
Absolutely. Yes.
There was a third officer on the scene who happened to be my sergeant. And when we were able to, while we were wrestling with him, actually get a knife away from the sergeant, grabbed him and pulled him away from him. He was out of the fray, so to speak.
Wow.
But it was pretty scary.
I'm sure it was, and I'm sure that, that it would probably took a long time for this child to recover.
Well, you know, it did. It also took a long time for us to recover. That was a terrible thing to go through. I don't think I got a good night's sleep for about 6 months.
Yes, and I think that, that police officers, as you indicate, LEOs, law enforcement officers, have a very tough job in that they see so much of, so much mayhem and murder and the seamier parts of life, and they encounter death and so many scenes that it would be very difficult.
Yeah, it's hard to forget it, and sometimes it's cumulative. As a matter of fact, going back to that situation, about at the end of that shift, I went back to that same apartment complex for another very bad domestic dispute. So it took a toll.
Okay, we have a quick 3 minute break. We'll be right back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Lance LaRusso, LRUSSO. He is the author of two books, When Cops Kill and Blue News. Now, you give us a little bit of your background. You were a police officer, you were an EMT, and now you're an attorney. How did this transition take place and why?
Well, I was an EMT first, and I did that while I was in college, and then moved on to being a law enforcement officer, and always wanted to explore law. I've always been fascinated by law. So while I was working as a cop, I was going to school at night and got a graduate degree and then got a law degree. And then eventually I started practicing law, representing law enforcement officers and a lot of other folks.
And it's because you saw a great need in representing.
I did. You know, I represent a lot of first responders, and there are a lot of situations they encounter that are unique. For instance, you know, when an officer gets injured in the line of duty, they may have workers' compensation to help them, and that may replace their salary, but a lot of them work part-time jobs, and if they can't work the part-time jobs, workers' comp is not going to help that. So we assist them with getting compensated for those as well. Plus, I've represented a lot of officers involved in shootings. I think I'm up to a little over 71 shootings that I've worked. And when we're dealing with those officers, we understand that there's a tremendous strain on them, even with a 100% justified use of force. That can affect them the rest of their lives.
Well, I think that even Jason Van Dyke mentioned that he prays for Laquan McDonald every day, every night. So I think that anybody that takes the life of another, whether it's in the line of duty or however the situation occurs, I think it would be very devastating.
Yeah, this is what we talk about in When Cops Kill. We talk about the fact that it's basically that people have said that the book is kind of like After the Smoke Clears. So you have the officer involved shooting, and then you have a criminal investigation, an internal investigation, prosecutorial inquiry, and then you have civil suits that follow. And, you know, in the situations that I've seen, in the case studies that I've done, the officer I've represented, none of them have wanted to take a life. And it, even when I said, like I said, when it's 100% justified, and 100% legal, it changes them forever. And when cops kill, I interviewed, for example, an officer who had been involved in the shooting. He shot and killed a suspect who had shot and killed two police officers. And 15 years later, when I interviewed him, he said his goal was to go 24 hours without thinking of the person that he shot and killed, and he hadn't been able to do it yet.
Oh, my gosh. I think that, that people are not really emotionally geared to take another person's life. in any circumstance. I think it's just, that's just not how we were created. That's my opinion.
Well, I think most folks, I think there are some people who, without a doubt, take lives and don't think twice about it, or worse, tell someone that if they don't provide their property, they'll forfeit their life. We call them armed robbers. It's pretty vicious human being that says to someone, give me what you have or I'm going to take everything.
Oh, well, you're right, because there is that segment of the population, whether they're psychopathic or whatever, just feel that they have the right or just don't care. And they shoot to kill for property or whatever. And
I talked to an officer the other day who worked in the juvenile justice department, and she became a street cop because she said that the first time she met a 13-year-old murderer, she realized it was a different world than she originally thought it was.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, there have been very young people who have murdered. What causes that? I've seen news articles about this, and you think, how does a child murder somebody?
Yeah, and that's, you know, how do they have the presence of mind, especially at that age, absent a need to survive? Because the use of deadly force in the context of a life or death situation when somebody's being threatened, that's a lot of a human instinct to stay alive.
Right.
But when you start talking about somebody just taking a life over, you know, money or disrespect
or whatever,
some sort of a gang initiation, it really makes you wonder what turned that person to believe that life was not sacred at all. But keep in mind that law enforcement officers make about 12 to 13 million arrests a year. And they are involved in deadly shootings about 980 times a year out of all of those situations. But that's the potential the officers have with every encounter. They could be encountering that person who does not consider life sacred and would take the officer's life in a heartbeat if they given the opportunity.
Indeed. Yes, I guess that's why I would never do that. And there's a lot of people that wouldn't. But I think it takes a special person to decide to put their life on the line, and to go up against.
Oh, there's no doubt.
Who knows what?
Well, exactly. And that's one of the reasons why we're seeing a 90% drop in recruiting nationwide. And I've told people, you know, a lot of, like you mentioned before, people having criticism for law enforcement. A lot of people criticize law enforcement, and I tell them, you know, we train officers very well in this country. When you have a situation that an officer acts improperly, almost invariably we can go back to their training, and their training failed them and failed the community. But if you don't like law enforcement officers, you're really not going to like the second string when we can't get people to even apply to become officers. And that's already becoming an issue with all of the anti-cop rhetoric, with officers being assassinated just for wearing a uniform and murdered just for going to work. You know, we're already having trouble recruiting officers.
What created this anti-law enforcement mentality? Is it the media? Is it that group of pastors, or is it, what caused this?
You know, there's different groups that have been responsible for it. This is what we talk about in Blue News. When people say the media, that's a loaded term. There is no the media. There's different segments of the media. And certainly, I've broken it down in When Cops Kill to formal media and informal media. So the formal media would be traditional professional news sources. Informal media would be things like blog and social media. So, it's hard to use the media as one big word, but there certainly have been segments of media outlets that have been very anti-law enforcement. And for instance, it has led to some very bad outcomes. So, for instance, the shooting of Michael Brown in 2014. We had people on news shows putting their hands up, and the hands up don't shoot, and the entire Black Lives Matter group. That was founded upon a lie. Michael Brown was never shot in the back. Michael Brown was not shot with his hands up in the air. And that's according to the DOJ report. But the information that came out, if you ask a dozen people on the street how many times Michael Brown was shot in the back, they'll probably give you a number. So we did have a bunch of anti-cop rhetoric after that. In addition, we've had people that have used that anti-cop rhetoric to raise a lot of money for their causes. And, you know, even the first couple of weeks that Barack Obama was in office, he was bad-mouthing law enforcement.
Right.
There was an encounter by law enforcement up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And instead of saying this needs to be investigated, he said the Cambridge police acted stupidly. You know, there was a great deal of anti-cop sentiment that was fueled during that administration. And it's very unfortunate.
Yes, it is. And of course, do you also think that social media, where anybody who has a internet connection can pretty much say whatever they want, do you think that this has also fueled it? And of course, when it comes from the top, like a president, then it allows anybody to say anything about, policemen, law enforcement, anywhere and anytime, right?
Yeah, it's interesting about the you mentioned Facebook and other social media.
Right.
I have a friend who has a term that I just love. He calls it keyboard warriors.
Yes.
The people that just, they sit in their basement and come up with all these ideas. And, you know, some of that is a perfect example of the philosophy that if you surround yourself with people who agree with you, you'll never know when you're wrong. So a lot of times folks wind up talking to themselves about themselves, and they never listen to another viewpoint. So they just, you know, consider that they're right all the time. But, you know, the problem for law enforcement is it's not just rhetoric. I mean, this has had some serious consequences. If you remember, just going back to the Ferguson situation, right while the midst of all that was going on, there was an officer who was randomly shot while he was standing at a post. He wasn't in a confrontation, wasn't in a dispute with anyone. He was standing there directing traffic and guarding a post at an intersection. He was shot. And what was ironic was he wasn't even a Ferguson police officer. He was brought in to help with crowd control.
Wow.
So the rhetoric that's come out, and, you know, people chanting, what do we want, dead cops? When do we want them now? People roasting police officers on a spit in effigy by using a pig with a police uniform on. That has no place in a civilized society. That's not a protest. That's inciting violence.
Yes, it is. And that has certainly been the case. And you think that this that this started at a particular time? When did you notice this hatred of law enforcement? What happened?
I think it's been there way before I even got involved. And it's really interesting. I've talked to some of the officers who have been working for, you know, 40 years, 45 years. They're retiring, or they're chiefs, or they retired 5-10 years ago. They swear, as bad as we think it is now, they said it was this bad in the 70s. And you look at some of the officers who were killed in the 1970s. Matter of fact, the governor of New York just pardoned a man who shot killed an officer, just walked up behind him on the street and shot him and killed him. So those types of attacks were happening then, and, you know, some of these officers that are telling me this, the older officers, are just so distraught. They said, you know, we thought this had stopped. We thought we had moved past this, and now we have people inciting that type of violence again against law enforcement.
Mm. Wow, I didn't realize that it went back that far. Or maybe we just are hearing more about it than we used to?
Oh, I think the proliferation of news sources, I think you are going to necessarily hear it more often.
Right.
And, you know, also, and this is what I talk about in Blue News, the advent essentially of a 24-hour news cycle, there's constantly space to fill. So the news sources are going to constantly bring issues to light and keep reporting on things. So the stories essentially never go away anymore in our cycle. Whereas if you look in the, you know, even probably as late as the 1970s, early 1980s, before CNN became a 24-hour news, you would have news that would take place in the morning, news that would take place in the evenings, maybe the 11 o'clock news. And then, just like the newspapers, the cycle would die until the following morning. Now you can read these stories 24 hours a day all over the world.
Right. Now, Chicago, historically, has always been kind of a violent area because of certain, well, the mafia and other elements of society that lived here. And it seems that certain cities are just notorious for being violent. And I think that, too, the attitude of the policeman has changed. Used to be, I think, that the policeman was the guy in the corner that helped you when you needed help. Well, first you want to comment on Chicago being notorious for violence first.
Well, Chicago has a lot of people killed and a lot of people shot. And clearly the answer to that is not gun control, because it hasn't worked there for 30 years, 40 years probably. But
right.
The more interesting thing about violence in these cities, and it's kind of the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about, is the largest employer in the United States is not Walmart, not the United States military, it's not the federal government, it's gangs. Gangs have gotten out of control in the United States. People close their eyes, close their doors, close their shades, and close their ears to the problem of gangs in every major city and even smaller communities. It used to be that the Chicago, LA, New York, San Antonio, Houston, they had them in Miami. They had the big problems with gangs. Now they're in smaller bedroom type communities, and they're vicious. They really are. I know that the president has brought to light some of the problems with MS-13, but what a lot of people just either refuse to acknowledge or just don't realize is that the prison system in the United States is so overwhelmed with a gang population that when we talk about the dangers of law enforcement, if you want to get into the dangers of being a corrections officer in the United States, that's a whole different type of danger. And they get killed too.
Right.
You know, as much as we talk about officers who were shot and killed in the line of duty, you know, we talk about, I think last year the number was 53, but we had over 240 officers shot in the line of duty last year.
That's amazing. And you say that gangs are the primary employer?
In the United States, more people are employed by gangs than any other employer.
Wow. Well, I know that there are a lot of innocent people that are shot because they are in the wrong car, in the wrong house, on the wrong sidewalk. We hear about this all the time, that there was a gang shooting. And of course, all the politicians, particularly in Chicago at this present time, are there for the mayoral run, they say, oh, we're gonna fix the gun situation. We're going to take care of this and get the guns off the street. We do have a quick break, and then we'll get back to that when we return. Be right back. All righty, welcome back. Our guest today is Lance LaRusso. He is the author of two books, excuse me, When Cops Kill and Blue News. And you mentioned previously that the biggest employer in the United States are gangs. And we were also talking about gun control. And Chicago certainly had gun control for a long, long time. People from Chicago cannot buy ammunition in Chicago. They cannot buy a gun in Chicago. They have to go to the suburbs or elsewhere to get a gun. But all these gangs have guns, and they use them freely, and the people who are currently running for mayor are all promising that they are going to end gun violence. Is that really going to happen? How would anybody, a mayor, end gun violence in Chicago when it hasn't been done previously?
Chicago put people in prison who use guns for the commission of a crime forever. Passing more laws that haven't worked in the past that only diminish the ability of law-abiding people to protect themselves is not going to stop criminals from using guns to injure people. And the problem is, you know, if you talk to the people in law enforcement in Chicago, and I understand, I've been to Chicago, I understand it's not the entire city. There are small segments of areas where officers know that there are problems with guns being sold on the street. The question is, what's going to happen when the officers go in there? You can't expect that somebody who carries a gun and deals drugs is going to go quietly. And they're going to get into a confrontation. And when they get into confrontations, are those same mayoral candidates going to stand behind them? You know, and this is the problem that we've been experiencing for a long time, is the mindset of these gangs, the level of violence they will bring is going to take place whether they're being arrested or whether they're dealing with a private citizen who happens to be an ATM machine. Most of the time, we know who they are. You mentioned Facebook before. You can go on Facebook and find someone who's a convicted felon in possession of a firearm, and they're holding one in a picture. Take them to jail. No reason for that person to be out. And yet we have people complaining about efforts to put people in jail and say, well, we have too many people in prison. Well, we need the right people in prison. Overwhelmingly, we have officers that are shot and killed, or we hear about these horrible situations where someone is killed during an armed robbery or a rape. The suspect has a criminal history.
Right. And they're not all illegal immigrants, as some people would have us believe. Some of them are. But these are career criminals, and they grow up being a career criminal. That is because they see that the money is good. Life may be somewhat short, but I guess the money is okay. And they're willing to take the risk.
Yeah, and the problem is that people ask all the time, why don't law enforcement officers support gun control more? Because it doesn't work. That's the bottom line. But I appreciate you talking about the books. The books are available on Amazon and BlueLineLawyer.com. And as I said, all the profits go to law enforcement charities.
Right. Now, you're saying the full program time, right?
I have 1 hour. I actually have another interview I have to go to.
Oh, okay. I thought you were staying for the whole time. Okay. That's okay. Thanks. Thank you very much for being on
the
program.
Thank you so much. It was great having me.
All righty. Thank you. All righty. We'll be back with 7.